Welcome to the Game History Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. My guest today is the fabulous Lev Raphael, but before that, we have Justine to give us another book recommendation.
How are you today, Brad?
I'm doing great, Justine. How about yourself?
I'm fine. We've had some stops and starts before this, and I'm going to probably erupt into giggles any moment, and nobody's going to know what's going on.
we'll just let them know it was before we went on the air. We got a little tickled.
We got a little punchy with starting and stopping, but we're okay now. We're starting. All right, so I am now recommending an entire series. I'm recommending the Nick Williams Mystery Series by Frank Butterfield. And this book, this series has, let me see how many he's got.
I think it's 37 off the top of my head. I could be wrong.
You could be wrong. I could be wrong. Let's see if I have the exact number.
Well, let's say it's a lot.
It's 32.
32.
It's 32, plus the 5 Daytona Beach mysteries, plus the 3 Nick Williams adventure series. And then he's got his new romantic series, Whit and Eddie. But I want to talk about the Nick Williams mystery series, because that fits right within our target audience here, is because they're coming from mysteries.
Absolutely.
So Frank does historical mysteries, and he's got 2 main characters, Nick Williams and Carter Jones, his husband, although it's back in the 50s, and calling each other husbands is a rather radical act. Nick Williams is the richest homosexual in the United States and maybe the world. He uses his money. He doesn't flaunt it so much as he just makes life easier, and he just buys his way through a lot of life's hardships, and he gives out money to pretty much anybody he dreams needs it. It's an interesting storytelling thing, because what happens is they don't end up having to deal with the usual problems of, gee, can we get a flight? They just buy a plane. Or if they're stuck someplace and nobody wants to rent them a car, they just buy a car. You know, in other books, yeah, that kind of adds a bit of realism, but it's a little boring in my mind. It's like, oh, you want a car? Here's magically a car. But it doesn't get them out of everything. There are a lot of scrapes that money doesn't get them out of. They end up being banned along the series, banned from a lot of countries, banned from a few states, tossed in jail a few times. FBI and mob guys are after them every now and then. The U.S. government spends a lot of time trying to trap them into something that they can shut them down and forfeit their money. But somehow they always get through, and each book, most every book has a mystery. A couple of them are adventures, and eventually the series of mysteries petered out, and that's when he started the adventure series. He has a lot of historical accuracy in his books, and he has a lot of famous people in his books. One of my favorites is number 23, The Stymied Star, in which Raymond Burr calls him down to the set of Perry Mason because he's found a body in his dressing room. You just get, Raymond Burr was a homosexual, and he comes down, he calls in the homosexual detectives, and he says, here's a body, now I'm going to go out and film. And that's it. Very matter of fact about the whole thing.
How fun.
It's a great time. And they try to figure out who this guy, who killed him, because the guy's got a whole phone book of men that he had sex with, and one of them obviously had it in for him. So they solve that mystery. They travel a lot in the books. At some point, they've been to all the continents except Antarctica. And Nick says that his husband, Carter Jones, who is a retired firefighter, is the handsomest man on all 6 continents. He's now checked it out and proven this to be a fact. Along the way, whenever they run into law enforcement, in a lot of the world, there's always a homosexual among the law enforcement who is fed up with the way he's treated or has to hide. And he goes to work for Nick and Carter's detective agency. And they eventually end up owning an entire skyscraper, the tallest skyscraper in San Francisco. And their detective agency sits on the top couple of floors.
Well, I got to say, the richest homosexual in the United States with a sexy fireman. Where could you go? Where can you go wrong there?
I don't think you can go wrong anywhere. I got to say, I don't think you can go wrong anywhere. And the books were all very interesting. The historical facts, there's always a little appendix at the end giving a little more detail about the historical facts. And there are times I will start a book at the historical facts at the end. And then once I finish it, I'll go off into an internet rabbit hole trying to find out more about some of the stuff he talks about.
Yeah, I know Frank does a lot of research.
Yes, yes. There are a lot of minor characters called Tom in the books, though. I got to say, every Tom, Dick, and Harry is actually named Tom. but other than that, these are great books. And I think you can pick them up out of order. And if you don't want to read all 30, what do we call it?
32.
32 of them. You can look to see on the summaries which topics you find particularly interesting. They all work as standalones, although their relationship develops and the collection of people grows as time goes on.
Well, out of 32 books, there must be one of them that would interest you, if not many more.
Yeah, but I like them quite a bit.
Great. Well, my guest, as you know, has a book being released by Requeered Tales, or re-released, and that's Lev Raphael.
I'm looking forward to it. Lev's a great guy, and Requeered Tales is very proud to be republishing the early books in his Nick Hoffman series. And this book, The Edom Wharton Murders, is the number two book in the series, and it was reviewed by the New York Times quite favorably when it came out.
Well, we talk about the book, and we talk about him because he's a fascinating man.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, well, see you next week.
See you next week, Brad.
We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. My guest, Lev Raphael, has published 26 books in genres from memoir to mystery to erotic vampire tale, had his work translated into 15 languages, and seen one sell close to 300,000 copies. Born and raised in New York, he moved to Michigan, which has been his home for more than half of his life. Welcome, Lev.
Hey, it's great to be here, or there, or wherever we are. Great to be anywhere nowadays, you know?
Well, I'm in L.A., you're in Michigan, my home state. So,
And Michigan has been my home state since for a very long time. And I'm actually a recovering New Yorker. You know, I belong to one of those groups. Like if I ever feel the need to pre-pandemic to ride the subway, I would call my sponsor and, you know, he would help me deal with it. So,
well, you went from one snowy environment to another. Now that I've lived in L.A., it'd be really tough to go back to the snow.
Well, you know, we've had less snow here than over recent years than we had when I first got here, and haven't had to take out the snowblower much. And, you know, I think we're seeing the effects of climate change here just like everywhere else. We are getting a lot more rain, that's for sure.
That climate change thing is a myth.
Ah, okay. Well, you can't believe everything you read. I shouldn't be so gullible.
Hey, can you imagine how bad it'd be if it was a myth? Or yeah. Wasn't a myth. So
yeah.
I gotta tell you, it's an honor to have you on the show. And the reason I say that is when I became aware of the gay mystery genre, I asked people for must read authors, and your name was always on the list.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, I think it's very cool to have you on.
Well, you know, this is what every author hopes for, is that people will talk about him nicely.
Well, it's always good stuff. Well, let's get right to it and talk about the latest edition of the Edith Wharton Murders. And that releases on May 9th with the...
June 9th. June 9th.
I'm sorry, you're right. June 9th. That's just a couple of days before the show airs, which is on June 11th. You told me this book made your dream come true, but you didn't give me much more than that. Care to elaborate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I grew up in New York City, so you have certain ideas of what would be success, what would make you a success as an author. And I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about prestige. And one of the things at the top of the list is getting reviewed in the New York Times. And The Edith Wood Murders was my first book to be reviewed in the New York Times. And it was a rave review, too. And I was quite literally jumping up and down for joy. I just couldn't get over it. It was a thrill that I can physically recall how over the moon I was. And then, of course, you know, I asked my now husband, I said, they can't take it back. And he said, no, it doesn't work that way. Once it's in print, they don't withdraw reviews. So it was just wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. And you know, like all books, I love everything I write. Otherwise, I wouldn't write it. But I felt with the series, that was the second one in the series, I felt I really had firm footing with that book. The first one I was finding my way, but with that one, I knew where I was going. I really knew where I was going with the series, and I just so it was great to feel acknowledged as well. And I was in there with another great New York mystery writer, S.J. Rosen, was reviewed, and there were, I can't remember everyone else who was in the column that time day, but they were all writers that I respected. So being in with people for only my second mystery, being in with writers who are so much better known than you, I mean, it just was a kaleidoscope of presence. You know, it just kept giving and giving and giving.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. You know, you hear a lot of writers say, well, I just write for myself. But come on, we all want to be acknowledged and have people love what we write.
Yeah, absolutely. And acknowledgement can come in lots of different ways. I mean, it can come from fan mail. It's not necessarily being on the bestseller list. I mean, there can be many things that will make you feel like your work counts. People, it matters to people. Michigan State University's libraries bought and updates my literary papers. They bought them some years ago, and they update them on a yearly basis. Well, that's pretty fantastic to begin with. Well, what I just recently heard was that a graduate student is coming from the University of Toronto next year to do research in my papers. That just blew my mind. I thought, you know, wow, I've had people do conference papers and write about my work in general in books and in scholarly journals. But this is like a whole new generation of people. This is a graduate student doing research in my papers to write about my work. That's just thrilling. That's really thrilling. And there's nothing like it. Well, I have to add that when I first sold my papers, I told a friend of mine who lives in New York, and she got very quiet. She's a writer who's better known than I am. She said she couldn't even donate her papers to the library she wanted to. They actually told her to throw them in the dumpster. They had too much stuff.
Oh, no. Which,
can you imagine? Can you imagine? That was such a bizarre comment from an archivist or anyone in special collections. But, you know, that's New York. I grew up there. I can imagine the attitude that she got.
Wow, quite a bit different.
Yep. It was very different.
One of your bios made me laugh because your work that went to the universities. You said you are now homework.
Yes. Well, that's another thing I never expected. I started hearing back in the early 90s, I started hearing from people who were saying, contacting me and saying that they wanted to teach a story of mine or an essay of mine. And I said, fine, you know, we would work that out. And I started, books of mine started showing up on course syllabi. And again, who do you show up with? It's kind of, who are you hanging with? The cool kids. The best one was someone at Fordham University taught me in a course with Philip Roth and Toni Morrison. And I said, it doesn't get better than that. I mean, those are two of my favorite authors. So again, you know, recognition, acknowledgement comes in many ways. And one of the funniest ones was some professor at, I think, UCLA or USC said, taught one of my books in American Jewish literature and said, and I was asking who else was on the list, and kind of the usual suspects, Philip Roth, Saul Bellow, and he said, and I unsolicited, he said, they preferred you to Saul Bellow, which cracked me up. Because at one point, Saul Bellow and I had the same agent, so I thought that was an interesting sort of little twist, karmic twist of some kind.
That's pretty amazing. Now, why did you start the series, and why feature a gay couple?
Oh, I started it because two parts to that. I'm the son of Holocaust survivors, and I'm kind of a pioneer in writing about fiction about that topic or dealing with that reality. I started in publishing in 1978, so I was way ahead of a lot of other people, and that's, in some circles, that's what I'm best known for outside of the mystery series. And my editor at St. Martin's Press said, you know, you've got a good sense of humor. You should write something funny. And I wasn't going to write something funny about the Holocaust or the Holocaust survivors and their children. And he said, you know, what do you think about that? And I knew academia pretty well. And I know academia is a very crazy, dog-eat-dog world, even though people hide it behind smiles. And I thought that it could be a good venue for mystery series. And I, at the time, I was feeling like, this was the early 90s, I was feeling like I wasn't seeing enough positive portrayals of gay couples. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'm going to do it. And to back it up, it was really spinning off my short stories, in the sense that I also felt, when I was writing some of my short stories that featured gay Jewish characters, I felt like in the culture at large at the time, gay Jewish men were perceived as nerdy and unattractive, kind of, you know, the Woody Allen type, But, you know, like all stereotypes, I thought that was such a narrow and bigoted way of looking at characters. So I made my Jewish men hot, which I thought, you know, I was married to a hot Jewish man. Why not? It made sense. And so I carried that on into the series. I both wanted to show a happily partnered, then they were partnered, eventually they got married, a happily partnered couple whose partnership wasn't contingent on anything. It was taken for granted between them, and it wasn't under siege. They were just happily living together, and the fact that they were happy together helped them deal with the reality of, you know, every so often they stumbled across a corpse, you know, and that's the reality of doing a series, right? Mm-hmm. Especially with an amateur mystery series, because Nick Hoffman is an English professor. He's not a cop. He's not a private investigator. He's not in any way related to the law or criminal justice. So, you know, you already are asking your readers to believe that every year or however often the books come out, he's going to be involved in the murder. So to balance that, you create other realities that make it more believable. Although I have to tell you, there have been times when there was a time that I did a reading in a college town, and someone raised that very question and said, well, you know, your character finds a dead person, finds a corpse or comes across a corpse in each book, how realistic is that? And someone at the back shouted, "Kill a whole department next time." One is not enough. One dead professor is not enough.
Hey, I come across a dead body at least once a week.
Yeah, really.
Obviously, this person didn't understand the mystery genre because...
Yeah, obviously not. No, nope, not at all. And or had not seen Murder, She Wrote, right? Because, you know, invite her to your picnic at your risk, right?
You know, the BBC, I saw an read an article from them that that town that Jessica Fletcher lived in, I can't remember the name, had a higher murder rate than El Salvador.
Yes, it's really true. I think you could have done a satire show, you know, she hire her as an assassin, because as soon as she shows up, someone is dead.
There actually is such a show.
Is there?
That she is actually the murderer.
Ah, okay.
It's either a book or a podcast. I think it's a podcast.
Probably is. See? And I missed it. I'll have to look for it.
Yeah. So, if I find it, I'll let you know.
Yeah, please do.
This edition of the Edith Wharton Murders was re-released by Recreate Tales.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, they contacted me. They're reissuing out-of-print gay fiction and gay mysteries, and there are a lot of them. I mean, they're because there are a lot of people who are interested in reading gay mysteries, and it's not just the LGBTQ audience that reads them. I remember years ago, Michael Nava, who's an amazing writer, mm-hmm. was at Outright, a gay writers conference, and he said that most of the fan mail he got was from straight women. That was his fan base. That was his largest fan base, and I think, you know, mystery readers tend to be pretty broad in their tastes and really like entering a world that they don't know and being enveloped by it and educated by it. Not in a didactic way, but just being introduced to a different world. Plus, they also read a hell of a lot. I mean, some mystery readers read a book a day. At the very least, they'll read one a week. That's a lot of books. And so they tend to look for new environments and new kinds of sleuths that they haven't encountered before. And the thing about, you know, a gay or lesbian or bisexual sleuth or someone who's trans is, you know, that character is going to have a different perspective on life, because to some extent that character is an outsider, so he or she or they will see things a little more clearly. You know, that is the experience of all minorities, is they look at the majority with a different set of eyes than the majority sees itself. So I think that's one of the interests of gay mysteries to begin with. And coming back to your question, so I wanted to write, I wanted to put those things in the series, but I also wanted to have fun. I mean, all my books are enjoyable to write, but I did want to write something funny. And the story and the mystery series grew out of a short story featuring those two characters who, when I was done with the story, I felt, you know, I would like to write something more about them, but I didn't know. I didn't know what to do. And then when my editor suggested a mystery, I already had these two characters that I wanted to give more life to.
Now, you talk about the mystery readers reading one a day or one a week. If they read one a week, that's 52 books a year. And I know you've been a reviewer.
Oh, yes, for a long time.
And an avid reader. With as much writing and reviewing you've done, are you still able to just sit down and enjoy a book?
Absolutely. I can turn off the reviewer very easily. You know, right now I'm reading a book, Pale Rider by Laura Spinney, about the Spanish influenza epidemic in 1918, and I'm just enjoying how beautifully detailed and written it is. if I pick up a book knowing that I'm possibly going to review it, then that's different. But yeah, I read for pleasure, and even when I'm reviewing a book, I'm still enjoying it. And if I'm not going to review it, there's always a chance, if it's fiction, that I'm reading it as a writer who has something to learn, because that's the great thing about being a writer, is that you can always get better. I mean, I know for sure that my mystery series got better as I wrote more books, and I know I'm a better writer than I was when I started publishing in 1978. My short stories got better. My everything that I do is better. Part of that also is that I've had the opportunity for various lengths of time to teach, and teaching writing and teaching writers and teaching literature has helped me become a better writer. It's all connected. You know, right now I mentor writers and teach online workshops at writewithoutborders.com, and that is it's enormously productive for me as a writer to be inside the manuscripts and help them discover what they can do to make the manuscripts more like what they need them to be, to find what's great in them and make it even greater. It's all part of the process of becoming, and that's why reading is, I've never stopped reading for pleasure. I am more patient now, maybe, now that I'm not reviewing as much as I was before. I mean, back in the 90s, I was probably reviewing for half a dozen different newspapers and magazines, and boy, if I wasn't grabbed by something in the first few pages or the first chapter, I was done. I had to move on. Now I might give something a little more time if people I know have told me that they really like the book. Then I'll read a whole chapter and see if I can figure out what I'm missing. But yeah, I read for pleasure. I can't not read. I mean, if I don't have a book or two that I'm in the middle of, I feel like something's missing. So in some ways, the pandemic has been good for me. I know that's a bizarre thing to say, but I haven't been traveling anywhere. I haven't been having lunches out with friends. So I am able, I have been able to read longer books and concentrate more. In the beginning of my lockdown here in Michigan, it was before I could figure out a schedule for myself. That wasn't the case, but I've been able to read with better concentration than I thought possible.
I enjoy reading. However, I go through this thing where I feel guilty when I read, because I'm like, I should really be writing. Even though I know every writer should read, that logic isn't what my reality feels like.
Well, you are writing. I mean, when you're reading, you're writing. I think so. I think that's the case. That's why I tell my students, because you are, whether you're doing it consciously or not, you're studying how that book is put together. You're studying how that person writes. You're studying the structure. You're studying the narrative line, how clean it is or not. You're studying character development. You're studying it all. You're processing it all unconsciously. So you really are writing, whether you know it or not.
That's an excellent point. You know, I worked in the hotel industry for 20 years. Most of it was in corporate offices, but part of it was in the hotel. And to this day, I cannot walk into a hotel without analyzing the lobby and looking at the trash. And it's the same thing with reading. You're 100% correct. When I'm reading a novel, I'm analyzing every bit of it while I'm reading it, and hopefully enjoying it as well.
I mean, it's hard to keep up with how much good writing there is out there that's new, and then discovering writers that you didn't know that are out there, or people who are, for instance, newly translated into English by new people. If I had a clone or an android who could read for me, then I could kind of speed it up somehow. I'm not sure how that would work, but someone's probably written a short story about that.
I'm absolutely certain of that. So tell us about Nick Hoffman. What kind of man is Nick?
He is someone who cares about his students a lot. He's also someone who is out of his depth because he grew up in New York, you know, an average New Yorker. He is totally unprepared to be involved in mystery and murder, and that comes close to home. He's got a good sense of humor. He's a little quip happy, as one of the characters describes him. He is very friendly. He's very loving, and he does not suffer fools gladly, which is a problem because there are a lot of foolish people in his department. It wouldn't be interesting if they were anything else, of course. He is a very dogged researcher, which is good because since he ends up investigating these mysteries, these murders alongside the police or sometimes against their wishes, it helps being someone who's very detail oriented. He reads a lot. He loves movies, so he's always quoting movies.
So he's not depressed and drunk hanging out at the diner.
Not at all. No, and he's just like a decent guy with a good sense of humor. Loves to swim. Doesn't mind the fact that there are a lot of handsome people at the gym. That's, you know, that's a plus. They don't charge you extra, right? When you sign up. And he's in a loving relationship with someone who is the writer in residence in the department, who is not at the time of the Edith Wharton murders is not as successful as he'd like to be. So Nick is happy, but Stefan, his partner, is kind of depressed. And he works through it eventually. He's had a troubled childhood and adolescence, so I don't want to give too much away, but it comes out. And the book features two rival Edith Wharton societies who Nick is dragooned into inviting to a conference to prove a point. The university is being lambasted because they're not doing enough to highlight the work of women. So someone says, well, why didn't you know Edith Wharton? Why didn't you run an Edith Wharton conference? As if that would be an easy thing to do. Nick tries to explain, well, you know, there happen to be two Edith Wharton societies and they both hate each other for complicated reasons. And he's overruled and he's forced to invite both societies. And of course, murder results. So the conference that was supposed to help him turns out to be an albatross.
I was going to ask you what the story is, and you gave it right to me. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Now, am I correct that there's 9 books in the Nick Hoffman series?
Yes, there's another one coming out next year.
Okay. So that's, I was going to say, is there any chance we'll see a new Nick Hoffman novel in the future?
Yes, that'll be out next spring.
Next spring. Awesome. Your background to me is so fascinating that it's hard for me to know where to begin, but you mentioned you're the son of Holocaust survivors.
Right.
And I am fascinated about you being a pioneer in writing about America's second generation, which, as you stated, you had a 1978 short story about children of survivors.
Right.
Tell us where that journey took you.
Oh, boy, it took me to places I never would have imagined. You know, I really only saw myself in the beginning as a short story writer. I never saw myself as writing beyond in any genres beyond that. And I definitely never saw myself as writing memoir. And, you know, one of the places that my journey took me to was Germany, which is, and I wrote a memoir called My Germany, which ended up being personally, I think, one of the most successful of my books because I did somewhere between 50 and 60 invited talks and readings for that book all across the U.S., in Canada, and all across Germany in two book tours that were sponsored by the U.S. State Department. It was really an amazing honor to be chosen as a representative of American art, culture in Germany. And Germany was a country I thought I would never visit because what had happened to my parents. And when some of my work was bought by a German publisher, they bought it with the understanding that I would go to Germany and tour. And that was the first tour that was sponsored by the publisher. And I went and I found myself feeling strangely comfortable there. And I actually kind of fell in love with being there. And I made a lot of really good friends there. People I'm still in touch with. I started studying German. And I think the most bizarre and wonderful thing that came out of it is I actually have done talks and readings in German, well, introductions in German. And but I've read from one of my books in German. And I've done it enough times that by the last time I did it, I really felt like the book had been written in German. I felt so close to the German language text. So that's been really an amazing part of my career. A whole strand of it has been being out in the world as one of the voices of that second generation, and just meeting people, other the children of survivors, having people write about that work. And, you know, that's why partly why that guy is coming from, that graduate student is coming from the University of Toronto, because his mentor is a scholar who has written extensively about my work in that genre. So it's beyond flattering. It's sometimes it feels stupefying when I think of this, all the things that have come to me in my career, things that I never expected, things that have been wonderful. Everybody, no matter how successful they've been, can tell you about things that have gone wrong in their career. But I have been very fortunate and surprised by the turn of events over and over. When you know, and it will come via email. I've been invited to be a guest professor at the University of Leipzig. In a year and a half. I mean, that totally blew my mind. So, it's a dream come true, because I really wanted to. I've never been able to be in Germany longer than 3 weeks. And this would be for a 4-month stint. So it would be fantastic.
Well, before we continue on with the interview, I want to let people know that if they want to find out more about you, you have a lot of information on your website. Which is levraphael.com, levraphael.com, which I highly recommend they take a look at. Now, you talked about your experience in Germany. What about readings and lectures that you've done in Israel? What was that experience?
Oh, that was wonderful. I did a reading at there's a group called the International Conference of Gay and Lesbian Jewish Organizations. For a while, my husband and I belonged to a gay and lesbian Jewish synagogue, informal synagogue group called Simcha, which means joy. And in the Detroit area, and through them, we were connected to this international group. So, and we went to conferences in Toronto and I think somewhere else now, I can't remember. I've gone to so many conferences over the years, sometimes it's hard to remember all the different ones. Toronto and London, that's it. And I did a reading in Israel, and that was, you know, going to Israel is amazing. Doing a reading there was amazing times 10. I'm running out of adjectives, which I guess I'll have to, I'll go to Walmart and they might have a sale on adjectives and adverbs.
There you go. There's so many adjectives that you can use for your life. I it's no surprise that you would run out of them.
Well, you know, I wanted to be a writer from second grade on, no joke. I fell in love with storytelling. I was an early reader, so I read above my grade, but I also loved being read to. My mother read to me, and I loved story hour in the library and at school. And the power of narrative just overwhelmed me as a kid, and that's what I wanted to be more than anything. But I also come from a family of teachers, so as I grew older, I realized that I hopefully combined those two. And for a while, I did, and eventually those paths separated. But now I teach in other forms.
Now, who were your greatest influences in fiction writing?
Oh, boy, God, there's so many. Well, you know, no one would be able to see it, I think, if I didn't mention it. Alexandre Dumas, because the Three Musketeers was my favorite book as a kid, and I read it. I read the copy that my parents' copy so many times it fell apart. I mean, the binding fell apart, pages fell out, and Isaac Asimov. Because the same thing happened with a copy of I, Robot. I was just engrossed in the adventure of the Three Musketeers, that other world, and fascinated by Asimov's creation of another reality. And so both of them, both writers, were some of the best storytellers that have ever existed, I think, and wrote an amazing number of books. And so those were two of my earliest influences. And I still reread them every now and then. And otherwise, the list would be really too long, I think.
Yeah, I get asked that question, and I'm like, where do I begin?
Yeah, those are the two writers that I absolutely adored when I was a kid. And I mean, you know, like at the age of 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, in elementary school, that's when I was reading them. And they were so much more interesting than the stuff we were reading in class. That's why I was, if they'd had it back then, they would have put me on Ritalin because I had trouble paying attention. You know, the stuff that we were doing just wasn't as interesting as the library books that I was bringing back, because I was also bringing back a lot of science fiction. And that was the golden age of science fiction. Heinlein, Asimov, Poul Anderson. So I was reading a lot of science fiction. I guess, you know, as a gay man, I think at some level, as a gay kid, I felt like an alien without having the words for it. And so it resonated at some deep level with me. And so that may have been why I was reading it. But I also just loved the stories and couldn't get enough of them. And so I took out as many books as I could every week. That was my house of worship, was our library, our local public library.
Well, Lev, I got to tell you, I wish I had an hour and a half show because I could just keep going on and on with you.
Oh, this has been a lot of fun. It was great talking to you.
Oh, it's been fabulous talking with you. And we'll definitely have to have you back and continue some of this conversation.
Sure, I would love that.
Well, thank you for being on.
It was great. Thanks for having me.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.